to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan, and joining me today is Robin.
How's it going?
And Nokulunga.
Morning. Okay,
it's definitely afternoon.
Maybe you should. Check the time. We're kidding. Right. So it's been a bit of a busy week so far. We had deputy presidents who weren't going to be deputy, and then it's madness. It feels like it's been 3 weeks in the last 3 days. But anyway, let's get on with the show. I'm going to kick things off today. On Tuesday, I went to go visit Google. But not just Google. I went to go visit Google and an organization called Web Rangers. And what they were doing was highlighting the importance of online safety during National Child Protection Week, which was first held in 1997.
I was about to say that. 10 points to me.
So Web Rangers is an initiative that teaches children and teenagers how to use the internet responsibly. So essentially what they'll do is they'll tell you that if you do X online, this is what the consequences could be offline. They also teach kids how to deal with cyberbullying and that sort of thing. At the moment, there are 24 schools in four provinces who are actively running the program. They actually had a few of the Web Rangers there who are school kids. And they were there to talk about their experience with the program and what they had learned and how much they had benefited from it. And one of the Web Rangers actually told us what the three main goals of the program are. And that is for it to be a youth-led initiative, to encourage children to be responsible digital citizens and use the positive power of the internet to affect change. Now, the cynical among us might realize that the positive power of the internet
Doesn't exist.
But these kids actually have a really, hopeful outlook. So one of the things that they really try to hammer home is that you can use the internet to kind of spread a message of good and rather than a message of ill will, which I thought was really nice, like through the eyes of a child. Web Rangers and Google aren't alone in this, though. They have partners in Media Monitoring Africa, the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services, Facebook, the Film and Publications Board, the Media Development and Diversity Agency, MTN, and Diana Schwartz Attorneys. So William Byrd, the director at Media Monitoring Africa, actually had quite a lot to say, and it was really interesting. he gave us an anecdotal story to start things off with how back in when he was a kid, if you wanted to get your hands on some adult material, you needed to know a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who had a cousin who had a father who the friend had stolen a Scope magazine from. And everybody, all the older people in the audience laughed, including myself. And then he changed tack very quickly and said that these days all you need is a mobile device. And one of the things that really struck a chord with me is he said, we've moved from a scarcity to an abundance of information, and young people need to be given the skills to self-regulate their behavior online. And that was one of the more important messages, I think, that came from yesterday's presentation roundtable meeting, was that if you're going to try and tell kids you can't do this or you're not allowed to do this, they're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I was in high school, it was like, don't do this, Brendan. And what did I do? I went and did exactly that thing. So what Web Rangers proposes is you give kids the freedom to monitor them, to regulate themselves. So you give them access to the internet. You tell them, here's what you can do. Here's the internet. Use it for whatever you want. But you need to be aware of what the consequences are for this offline. So if you're going to go and cyberbully people, there are going to be real-world consequences for you. Another thing that was really, really interesting was William Byrd saying that when looking at online safety, we should take the Constitution into account, which I thought was really interesting because the Constitution kind of protects all of our human rights and all of our rights and responsibilities. And online safety should take the same sort of approach to how we tell people how to behave online. And they actually had a principle. So there's a school here in Johannesburg, Macaulay House Christian, Catholic school, and they actually had the principal of that school. His name is Ross Davis, and his school has been running the program for a couple of years now. And one of the things that I think was really nice is he said, Web Rangers talks the language of the youth, and it has led to the success of the program. Nowadays, it's cool to be a Web Ranger, and it's something that the youth strive for. And I think what shocked me the most is how in tune these kids were with what was happening online. You know, like I thought that I knew what was going on online and how like things are used and how people use things. But these kids were just incredible. Like they have such good ideas. So one of the questions that came up during the roundtable discussion was, what three things would you like to see implemented in a social media policy? And the first two, one of the three things that one of the Web Rangers said was that there should be a social media policy for staff and there should be a social media policy for parents, because a lot of the stuff that happens is, and the third thing they said was that the social media policy at a school should be adopted at home as well, so that kids don't do one thing at home and then do another thing at school. Because the idea is to get people comfortable online and have kids online as much as possible, because there are some really good resources out there for them, but there are dangers, let's be honest. So Web Rangers tries to educate kids about what they can do online and gives them like real advice about what to do. And if something goes wrong, how to address it. If there's an incident of cyberbullying, how to deal with that. So I think it was really nice to see this conversation happening and not just having old people sitting there going, well, here's the rights that the young people need. Actually having the school children there going, well, this is what we want to do. Like to kind of assume that you can just keep people offline forever is a bit stupid. Like in this day and age where there is literally internet all around us, what we should do is encourage people to be safe online, teach them how to use the internet and how to use it safely. And I think Web Rangers is doing a really, really good job of that. Of course, we'll link to the story for you to have a look at. And I think it's something that you should really look at if you are a teacher or an educator, you're a principal. If you are a parent yourself, go and check this out. Go and check Web Rangers, see what they do. It's just a really, really great way of bringing kids online. Because it's not saying, well, these are the rules, and if you break them, your life is over forever. It's, here are the rules, and here's what happens if you break them. Off you go. And trust them to make the right decisions. I think, as well, parents should be a little bit more like, there are tools. This is something that Google brought up during the presentation, is that as a parent, you should also be actively involved in what your child is doing. You know, like if your kid is online, you should have tools in place to kind of monitor them. Don't say to them, oh, I'm going to restrict this, I'm going to clone this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Rather just have a way to monitor what they're doing. Stuff like Google's digital well-being apps, which are really nice to monitor how much time you're spending online. And if people say that those are really stupid, I'm just going to say that I went from 8 hours of YouTube a day to 3 because of Google's digital well-being app. Very, very cool. And it's basically just kind of saying to people, look, right, we grew up in an age without internet. One of the words they used is a digital migrant, which I thought was really, really funny. We digital migrants, whereas kids of today are digital natives. They've grown up on the internet. The internet has been around since they were born. So what we should do is educate kids about how to use the internet, the dangers, how to address those sorts of things. And I think Web Rangers does a really, really good job with that. And then having the backup of places like Media Monitoring Africa, which helps people fight fake news and helps people spot fake news and that sort of thing. And then government getting involved in this as well. The one thing that I was a little bit concerned about was the involvement of the Film and Publications Board, for obvious reasons, as we've seen in the past. But they seem very open to kind of going, well, we need to regulate the platforms rather than the people, which I thought was really kind of refreshing and kind of, okay, all right, they're not looking to police us all yet. But yeah, so we'll link to the story at the bottom of the page, as always. And check out Web Rangers if you are an educator, a parent, or even just a kid that's interested and you want your school to get involved. I think it's something that is well worthwhile.
Yeah, if I could just take, I guess, the cynical point of view here. So I understand the kind of the point of web reviews in terms of wanting to educate children around the dangers of the web.
Yeah.
But was there any kind of information or statistics around how effective a tool it was in stopping that kind of behavior? Because cyberbullying is going to happen regardless, but is it an effective kind of initiative to actually curb it?
So from listening to the kids, they didn't give us any sort of metrics to measure how successful the program is. But from what I heard at the roundtable events, so take it with a grain of salt, was that the kids felt that they were a lot safer online. And in terms of, and when I say that, I don't mean that they felt like, oh, everything's fine, everything's hunky-dory. They were very well aware of what the dangers were. They are able to identify like stuff that I wouldn't even have noticed. Like things, one of the examples that they gave was a WhatsApp group that had been created at a person's school where people were just being bullied. And they went to the teachers and said, hey, listen, this is happening. This person set it up. Can you please help us? And that person actually went through disciplinary measures, right? So in terms of how do they measure it, I mean, it's how do you measure how safe somebody is? But what I found refreshing was that these kids knew how to deal with things that I don't even know how to deal with, like trolls, you know? These kids have, like, they have a better understanding of dealing with trolls than I do, and I feel like I've been on the internet for years. And so there's that. And then also just the way that they approach these things. Like, one of the things that Ross Davis said is that when creating a social media plan or policy, it should be incorporated into your school's code of conduct. And then that whole document needs to be a living document. Once a month, you need
and
to sit
what
down.
That's what the children kind of adhere to when they're...
Absolutely. So once a month, they sit down with learners from the school and say, right, is this still relevant? Do we still need to do this? Do we still need to do that? And the kids are an active participant in this because they're on these platforms all the time. I mean, no offense to Mr. Ross Davis, but he's a middle-aged man. I'm pretty sure he doesn't know what the latest trends on Insta or Twitter or Facebook are. I mean, he said at one point that they were trying to regulate Facebook and all their rules were pertaining to Facebook. And the kids came to him and were like, so nobody's on Facebook. Like, you need to adapt this stuff. Like, you need to look at WhatsApp, Instagram, TikTok, all these things. I've never heard TikTok more times than in this presentation. So, yeah. So in terms of measurements of how effective it is, there's nothing just yet. But I think that it's something that just from seeing these kids talking, I think it's definitely something that schools need to investigate.
Cool. Good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully it does the job.
Yeah, I hope so. Nokulunga, you've got something for us.
Okay. I think yesterday. The Minister of Higher Education and Training, Naledi Pandor, appointed a ministerial task team to advise on matters relating to sexual harassment and gender-based violence in universities.
Yeah, and that was in response to an open letter that was sent out last year?
No, in March.
In March this year.
What open letter? What's the open letter?
Oh, okay. Students penned out an open letter to the minister in March.
Okay.
Talking about issues that were, like, talking about university issues relating to sexual harassment and gender-based violence.
Okay, all right.
So, the minister.
Yeah.
Yes. The minister appointed ministerial trust team. That's what they call it.
Okay.
Yeah, of 9 members. So... they don't say exactly where the 9 members are from or what exactly they do, but here I see there are professors and so on, and doctors and so on.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then also the South African Union of Students, SAUS.
Okay, yeah.
Some members from that. So, yeah. And then the task team is going to deal mostly with the advice the minister on. Okay, sorry, guys. I'm reading a bit. They're going to advise the minister on the effective introduction and implementation of the policy framework to address gender-based violence with a specific focus on universities. Right? And then also, a possible inquiry into sexual harassment, gender-based violence, and gender-based harm in the university sector, considering work that has already been carried out. Also measures to ensure that sexual offenders do not escape justice and repeat offences in other institutions.
So is there kind of a time frame as to when the TAS team is like...
Oh, yeah. The TAS team is going to begin in June. They have a 12-month period to advise, so meaning from this year, June, to next year, June. Mm. And then after that, they're going to identify the areas of sexual harassment and also advise on how to manage the sexual harassment in universities.
Yeah, obviously that's a huge issue because it's been more than a decade since I was at university, but I've got two younger sisters who are both studying at the moment. And yeah, that's specifically for women at universities, it can be a very daunting place to be. I've heard quite a few stories about young women that are on campus residences and have to deal with a lot of just kind of vile behavior. So again, I might be taking maybe a cynical view, but I really hope that this task team can actually come together and bring something tangible to the table. Because a lot of the time we kind of see stories where a woman accuses a man of rape, but due to kind of public pressure or just an inability to actually see the case through, it often gets dropped. So hopefully they have more discussions around that, because that's perhaps probably the biggest area that I think there's scope for development in terms of policies and regulation and stuff like that. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Yeah, so like, have universities basically been like monitoring this themselves, I assume, up until this point, where they would have their own rules and in their code of conduct and that sort of thing to kind of fight this?
I'm sure they do, but I think it's probably outdated.
Yeah. I'm making massive assumptions here, but I would assume that it's something that's outdated, hasn't been looked at in a while. And the fact that government's now getting involved, like that's good, but on the same token, maybe should government not have even been involved in these sort of things from the get-go? I mean, we talk about days of activism for against violence against women and children and like National Child Protection Week and all these things, but like if our policies don't reflect that, that's worrying, you know? Like, I don't know. I think that like it's nice that this is happening, but I mean, you're appointing a task team now for a 12-month period. Let's say that in that 12-month period, you discover XYZ, but then there's also ABC that you don't see in that 12-month period. I don't know. It just feels like, I'm not saying it's too little too late, but I feel like more needs to be done than just a ministerial task team of 9 members.
Yeah, I don't want to like poke holes in just before the team's actually started doing its work. But a lot of time when government gets embroiled in these kinds of things, all the kind of, I guess, I want to say, the excitement or like the energy around it starts grinding to a halt because it gets kind of sucked into this kind of quicksand pit of government dragging their feet on a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing is like we have a task team, like there's this running joke in South Africa about like, oh, there's been a problem. Let's appoint a task team. Or there'll be a commission of inquiry. There'll be this, there'll be that. But there's seldom action following those sorts of task teams. And like, cool, thank you, Ms. Pandor, for doing this and setting up the task team. But as a citizen and somebody who has people that are in university, especially women, what are you going to, what is the outcome of this? What is the end game? You know, are we looking to like I know that you mentioned like they want to set up things where people don't get out, like don't repeat offenses, but how do you do that? Right? Do you set up a database full of people? Then what's the implications of that database? How is that database secured? How do we check that people are testifying accurately? Are we now involving the courts? How does that court case get handled? There's all these questions that start coming up, and sure, there's 12 months to do it, but like, I think it's a problem now. Like, if a university student undergoes sexual harassment or sexual violence or harm, like, that's not something that takes 12 months to do. It should be something that is addressed now. Maybe I'm being a bit too harsh to government here, but I think that it's something that should be ongoing rather than, okay, we're going to set up this. Why don't we sit down and go, okay, here's the law, here's the consultation, let's do this sort of thing. And get the ball rolling rather than, okay, well, we're going to set up a task team and in 12 months, we'll see how they fare and what they come up with.
I doubt that's actually what they're saying. I'm thinking in my mind, it's just that to see what the policies, what the individual university policies say on these sexual harassment and gender-based things. So they say that they want to identify weaknesses in policies. It's not that the universities don't have policies.
Okay.
It's not that the government doesn't have policies. It's just that they want to identify the loopholes.
Okay. Yes. Okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah, they want
All right,
to identify
so I was the misunderstanding.
They want to identify.
Does that take 12 months though? That it just seems to me, and I apologize for being cynical about this, but 12 months shouldn't take 12 months for you guys to identify loopholes and policies across, you know, if you especially
but we do have 26 public universities.
Yeah, but I mean, but you sit down
okay,
and you
26
get
sets of
rules
to look through. That shouldn't take 12 months.
That should take a day.
But you must also remember they'll also be looking into cases that were reported, that were mishandled, that were...
Fair enough. But in terms of the policies, though, in looking at the university policies, why do we have to take a year to do that? Why can't we look at all 26 universities' code of conduct, their rules, in one day and say, wow, okay, UCT, as an example, your policy's really bad. You need to adjust this quickly. Here's what your framework should be. Like Robin says, I don't think that that task should take 12 months. Like, fair enough, having to go through cases and see where things were dropped, I 100% agree, that needs to be given due diligence. But when it comes to protecting our students and our women, like, that should be something that is of the highest priority, not in 12 months' time we will see where we come out with, you know?
Well, our government, so we'll have to see how this is going to pan out. And another thing this task team is going to manage, they say that they're going to manage... After the students get out of universities, I forgot what they call the name, but
postgrad.
Yes, postgrad. After that, when the students apply for jobs,
yeah,
the student says that female students say that they get sexually harassed.
Yeah,
meaning that they get to have to offer sex for jobs.
Yeah.
So the task team is gonna look into that also. So. It's not only going to affect university students.
So that's something that should
everyone.
Yeah, that should definitely be something that should look at. Mm-hmm. And I agree there that should be also a high priority, especially in terms of harassment and gender bias. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, he's a man, he should get a job. Mm-hmm. No, everybody should be given equal opportunity. Yeah, it sounds hopeful though. It seems like government is like taking an active role. But I wish that there was a bit more, what's the word?
Yeah, I don't want to sledge what government is trying to do. I'm all for the initiative and the task team, and I really hope that they, in 12 months' time, come up with something tangible. But yeah, it just seems like it's a course of action that's just there to kind of placate students at the moment.
Yeah, it's sort of like, oh, you guys are angry. We'll
don't
do
worry,
this.
We've went to the task team in 12 months time.
Yeah.
And to my mind, I'd actually like to see what happens in 12 months.
Me too.
This time, June next year, I want to see kind of what their findings were and what kind of policies they were in.
And see if legislation is formulated around it.
Mm.
Like, that would be really interesting. I mean, we have one of the best constitutions in the world, and, like, it astounds me that this is only happening now because of that fact. I mean, we have, like, stuff in our constitution that most nations don't even have.
Mm.
So the fact that this was not in it is a little bit disappointing as a South African. But, I mean, better late than never, right?
Yeah, best of luck to the task team, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, Robin, you've been keeping up with Computex news.
Yeah, that's right. Computex currently underway in Taipei, in Taiwan. Yeah, so the event, I guess, officially started yesterday. 28th.
Yeah.
yeah. But as is often the case with global events, manufacturers like to get ahead of the competition, and they have a few announcements prior to the actual event kicking off.
Yeah.
And that was the case this time around as well. So there have been quite a few announcements. We've kind of earmarked a couple that we think are noteworthy. And the first one was from AMD, who kind of showcased their new Radeon RX 5700 series, which is also their first chipset to, well, rather their first graphic cards to feature the Navi GPU kind of architecture.
Yeah.
This one is specifically designed at more of the mid-range space, and that seems to be a bit of a trend for Computex 2019. It looks like a lot of manufacturers are designing hardware and releasing offerings that are kind of catered more to the mid-range space, trying to deliver as much computing power as possible to that kind of segment of the market.
More bang for your buck,
yeah,
as it were.
it would appear that good way. So back to the Radeon RX 5700. So this particular model has a few noteworthy elements apart from the Navi architecture. One is that it's a 7-nanometer in terms of its design. It also supports PCIe 4.0 as well as kind of GDDRS RAM. RS6 RAM, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, these numbers always get a bit confused.
It's a swathe of numbers and abbreviations and stuff. Now, like, I really am interested to see how that graphics card performs, because like AMD usually uses high bandwidth memory for its like flagship graphics cards, and I'm interested to see with the GDDR6 how that performs alongside this. But the 7-nanometer design is really interesting for me. I think they're like one of the first to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't think NVIDIA has hit 7-nanometer yet, so I'm really, really curious to see how well this performs in games, obviously, because I think that's what everybody's going to use it for.
Yeah, I think it's good that you mentioned NVIDIA, because during their presentation, AMD kind of took slight aim at NVIDIA and kind of compared the new Radeon RX 5700 against the NVIDIA RTX 2070.
Oh, yeah.
And they reckon that their GPU is doing about 10% better in terms of performance. So I guess we'll have to see ourselves if we get the chance to kind of test them out.
Yeah, and I'm also curious to see whether the 7-nanometer design makes its way into it lends itself towards like mobile solutions, so your sort of laptops and that sort of thing. So I think it would be really interesting. It's very interesting to see that AMD is kind of punching up now.
Yeah.
You know, as it were. Not to say that they physically, but I just mean like they're starting to compete again, which is really nice.
Yeah. Hopefully, we should get a bit more information about the RX 5700 around the 10th of June.
Okay.
AMD is scheduled to have an event then, I should also mention that the GPUs are slated for launch in select region in July, so hopefully South Africa kind of falls into that window as well.
I hope so.
So we'll see what happens.
We do hope so.
And then another manufacturer that showcased some new internal hardware was Intel and their new 10th generation Ice Lake CPUs, which they have been talking about for quite some time.
Years, it feels like.
Yes. Yeah,
so probably not years, but it feels like years.
It could be 2 or 3 years, but yeah. so they're now available. They've now been launched. They've been launched. And these kind of chipsets are also kind of marketed towards the mid-range space. The first wave that Intel are reading are under the U-branded series, and they'll have i3, i5, and i7 kind of flavors available.
Okay.
So
just for everybody that's listening, the U-series is the mobile,
yeah,
the mobile side of things for Intel.
Yeah, and then this specific chipset is, well, what Intel are touting is that it can manage clock speeds of up to 4.1 gigahertz, and they're also claiming an 18% increase in the instructions per clock, which is quite handy indeed.
Absolutely.
They're also touting the Iris Plus graphics system for this particular model. So again, they are kind of perhaps looking at that kind of mid-range space for gamers who perhaps don't necessarily want a hardcore offering, but they do want something that can handle a bit of gaming now and then.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Some of the other notable features about this chipset is it supports Wi-Fi 6.
Yeah.
Or rather 802.11ax if you want
the full name. The
fancier name. It's also got Thunderbolt 3 support as well as HEVC/VP9 4K 60 frames per second video encoding acceleration, which is nice for video editors if you're interested in that stuff.
Yeah, and the Wi-Fi 6 inclusion is really nice as well, being able to have more bandwidth, have more devices connect to it. Mm. Also, if you want to stream 4K to a compatible monitor, there are already Wi-Fi 6 supporting routers out on the market. So it's nice to see that devices supporting that standard are coming to market now.
Indeed, indeed.
So very, very nice. When can we expect to see more about these chipsets?
I'm not too sure yet. They are heading out to OEMs, so we're assuming perhaps IFA in September, we should be seeing actual devices hit the market, or at least unveiled at the bare minimum. So your likes of Acer, perhaps Asus as well, or someone.
Yeah.
You could be touting these new Ice Lake chips. Yeah, so I guess now we can talk about devices. It seems like the trend for Computex 2019 is a lot of screens. In particular, we saw Asus, they released a new ZenBook Pro Duo, and the Duo kind of alludes to two 4K screens that are going to be on the notebook. There's one that obviously takes care of your main display, and there's another that sits above the keyboard.
So between the display and the keyboard.
Yeah. It's kind of billed as a multitasking device. Okay. And we kind of saw Asus do something similar with the trackpad in a notebook that they released last year.
Yeah.
But now this kind of, I guess, ups the ante a bit, not only in terms of the real estate that the actual second screen has, but also the quality of the resolution.
And you still get a trackpad as well.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just not in the center.
It's smaller now, and kind of sits on the side.
Yeah.
I guess where your
numpad would be, yeah. So that looks cool. I like that. It seems like something that's made for streamers.
Yeah, so I guess in their kind of promo materials, they showed a Twitch stream being run on it. They also showed that someone multitasking with certain graphic design applications and things
okay.
like that. So yeah, I think it is being built as a strong multitasking tool. And to kind of pair with the dual screen setup, Asus have said that there'll be 14 and 15-inch versions of the device. They'll also be able to run up to a 9th-gen i9 processor, depending on what kind of internal specification you opt for. And that'll be paired with an NVIDIA GeForce RTX 2070 GPU. So it should be able to cut the mustard.
Yeah, and it should be able to run both of those screens, hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
So, like a lot of the stuff that's been showcased in Taipei this week, we have no official word on pricing and availability. That said, Asus are hoping to have more information around the third quarter of 2019, and that, again, hopefully includes South Africa, because South Africa is a big kind of region for Asus, and
yeah,
they bring their nice new shiny laptops. Yeah,
yeah. People are going to ask us about what about the Asus phone? Nobody cares about this. Not even internationally. I don't think people want the Asus phone. Yeah. Let me not say nobody cares. People do care about it. It's just
I think people in Taiwan, which is Asus is Taiwan.
Yeah,
yeah. They'll care about it, but I don't think locally.
Yeah, with the notebooks and stuff like this, like Asus brings these things to the country because they sell.
Yeah. Another a notebook maker that showcased a new device is Dell. And in particular, they showed off their new XPS 13 2-in-1,
which
has previously been a really solid device and
mm-hmm.
has performed quite well locally. So for this 2019 refresh, they've done a few interesting things. One is they've made it thinner and lighter, as well as up the real estate of the screen by 7%. Depending on which model you go for, you can get up to a 4K UHD plus display, but I'm sure that's going to cost quite a bit. The display itself is that kind of trademark Infinity Edge that Dell have been working on for quite a while now. So it's an edge-to-edge display. And then on the performance side of things, the Dell saying that up to a 10th-gen Intel Core processor, I'm assuming the ones that we've
just talked about.
That level up, so probably I'm assuming the i7 of that
Stack.
Well, feature they haven't gone into detail as to that specific element just yet, but they do say that performance has increased by about 2.5 times compared to the previous generation of XPS 13.
That's a lot, actually, like 2.5 times. That's
yeah, we'll definitely have to put that to test ourselves.
Yeah.
So, Dell are listening, please.
Please send us one.
Just give us one. It would be nice. another nice feature is Dell are claiming 16 hours of battery life, which, if true, is great.
Yeah, so absolutely. So I have the previous generation XPS 13, not the 2-in-1 version, just the plain notebook. And I get like 8 to 10 hours depending on what I'm doing. So if they can get 16 hours out of that, or if you really can get 16 hours out of this notebook, that is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
That's two working days of battery life out of a notebook, which is great.
Yeah, so I'm quite keen to kind of see if they can actually live up to what they're billing there. Like mentioning, everything at Computex has been shown this week. We don't have local availability information or pricing information just yet. Dell are saying possibly August for South Africa.
Yeah.
It's unofficially confirmed just yet, but We don't have any pricing information. We know stateside it's starting at $1,000, which is about $14,900. And I think you can expect this one to climb up to perhaps 25 to 30K mark.
Yeah.
If you're going for the higher spec option.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, we'll have to wait for Dell to kind of officially confirm what the pricing is
going to be. I mean, it is a lot for a notebook, but these are sort of, these are your ultrabook categories. Yeah, well,
these are your MacBook competitors.
Exactly.
So they're going to have to be, well, you're paying a premium.
I suppose you get what you pay for. And like, I'm very happy with my XPS 13. Would I upgrade? It depends on the price. And if Dell sent us one.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for this week's AfriCast, ladies and gentlemen. Nokolunga has ducked out. So it's just going to be myself and Robin saying goodbye to you. We'll see you again next week. From myself, Brendan Lodge. Cheerio from Robin Chetty.
Cheers.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.